30 seconds, and we've had a go for auto sequence start. The SRB hydraulic power units have started. T-minus 21 seconds, and the solid rocket booster engine gimbal now underway. T-minus 15 seconds.
T-minus
10, 9, 8, 7, 6. We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1, and liftoff. Liftoff, and it has cleared the tower.
Surgeons Radio Network calling. Insurgents Radio Network calling. This is the Insurgents Radio Network calling.
The station with the happy difference.
And this is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy, in the heartland and in the bunker. Ready for another big shoe here today, right here on off stage. Yeah.
Quiet, numbskulls, I'm broadcasting.
P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581 is the address. Address your mail to either Box Holder or Tom Metzger or the Insurgent, and we'll get it, no matter which one you use. Yeah.
Open your mind out there. Open your mind. Think for yourself. Logic. Use logic. This is Terrible Tommy in the bunker on this day that I'm not going to talk about. At least I'm not going to mention the holiday or why you shouldn't pay any attention to it. In fact, it's a little bit nauseating and all that kind of good stuff. But before I've got something that'll really nauseate you and offend some people. A couple of points before I go into it. Remember when I was talking about Hitler and the book Dr. Feelgood, the Jew that started out in Berlin concocting methamphetamine concoctions and selling them all over Berlin, but furnishing Dr. Morell, Hitler's personal doctor, with this concoction. And I said, I think that led actually to his paranoia, and it led to his ill-timed and ill-thought-out attack on Russia. But, you know, there is one picture they show of Hitler speaking at a party congress that I've always thought was a little strange. And once I found out that he was on the crystal meth, I know why. And that picture is he's with a uniform on, he's standing at the podium, and he's really into it, and he's holding his hand up high, but you can see the wildness of his eyes and the sweat actually on his brow. I submit to you that when he gave those speeches, he was on the Jew's concoction. Yes. So anyhow, and then here's one more thing to couple with that. Remember, Hitler was injured in World War I. He was gassed. And he obviously had PTSD. Nobody talks about that. So he comes back and he wants to do something about the defeat and becomes a military informant. Probably had a lot to do with his PTSD. And then we don't know how long or how deep that affected him. It sure affected him to make the very bad decision to knock off a whole bunch of his brown shirt leadership. About 1,700 people killed. of people that were completely loyal to Hitler. And then it's questionable how early Hitler got onto the meth and this concoction by Dr. Feelgood. So you see the picture start evolving here? Think about it. Now, the other thing is this. People talk about, of course, slavery in and out, and racism and all that. Of course, if we didn't have millions of black people in North America, there wouldn't be this so-called racism. There wouldn't be any reason for it any more than there was any reason for me to be a racist when I was a kid around here where I live now, because there were no blacks around. If you're in total separation, which is the perfect racist, actually, you don't worry about things like that because you don't see them, you don't know about them, you didn't have television to watch about it, hardly anything said on the radio and like that. But remember one thing. Now, I was going to look this up this morning, but I'm not sure. I think England outlawed the slave trade before the revolution started. I think. So if England stopped the slave trade before the revolution, and England could have easily won the revolution because they had the biggest, strongest navy in the world. They didn't have to put one boot on the ground in the colonies. No, they didn't have to, because they could have blocked with their ships, they could have blocked every port into the states and the colonies. And the colonies would have lasted about, what, a couple of months maybe, until they'd run out of things. And that would have been it. So now think what would have happened after that. See, the states were still connected to England. England had outlawed slavery. And would England have gone even farther and said, now we're going to have to get rid of all these slaves you've got? Or not? Possibly not. They'd have possibly said, oh, that's okay, go ahead with the ones you got. But I think there'd have been a big move by the British public, and the United colonies would have been still a part of it, to quit it all and get rid of it and repatriate these blacks back to Africa. So, thus the United States would not be drowning in blacks. So you see how linkage, I keep talking to you about linkage, and you know, you can say what if and all that kind of stuff, but there's certain things we need to know that if they hadn't happened, or if they did happen, things would be a lot better or a lot worse. So at this point in my life, I think we would have been better to not have had a revolution, stuck with England, went along with abolishing the slave trade, and then gone along with a bigger question of deporting the blacks back to Africa or wherever they came from, which would have been resisted a lot, and England would have had to make what they should have done then is break up the plantations into small farms so that the bulk of the white people in the South could make a decent living, build schools, get a decent education, build industry in the South, and so forth. So anyhow, these are some of the things that go through my mind. And then, of course, the Hitler thing. To me, there's a linkage there between PTSD of the First World War that affected his decisions right on up until he got hooked on meth and the meth through this Jew Jacobson, who then he evidently wanted to charge too much after a while, and the brown shirts came after him, and he jumped on a boat and boogied over to Brooklyn and started the same thing on top movie stars and so forth, and then including John F. Kennedy and a lot of other politicians. So You know, when they say, what do you got against Jews? You got a lot against Jews. If more against Jews than you should could ever think of, including creating a bunch of Jews creating Christianity, to which even the most Jews thought was wacko from the beginning. So whacked out that they went along with they wanted to get rid of this. Well, Jesus, if he had existed, they would have wanted to get rid of him. The rabbis know there was no Jesus. You go to some big rabbi that's candidly, maybe get him drunk and say, do you really believe there was a Jesus? And he'll tell you, no. But you know why they can't say it? If they came out and said there is no Jesus, can you imagine the evangelicals? They'd be going after every Jew they could find with a hatchet, So the Jews are sort of stuck on a their own petard. They use Christianity, yes, but every now and then Christianity goes bonkers or maybe a little sane and attacks them, and then they have this symbiotic weird relationship between the Jews and the Christians. And so the Jews say, well, we're going to have to take it in the ass once in a while from these crazy Christians, because if we ever come out with the truth that there was no Jesus, and these big shot Christian preachers lose control of these herds, and the white race develops either a racial religion or sticks with no religion at all. Now we're going on to another very important subject. You know, there's so-called Nordicists out there in this struggle. Well, they defined it even farther down and get more minuscule, that the only biological and spiritual and psychological Aryans are in the Northern Europe, specifically Denmark and Sweden and places like that. But my opinion is that the Nordics have become very soft over the years, very much into making a deal with non-whites and all that kind of stuff. And beyond that, going out of their way to help non-whites that are killing whites. That's what this show is going to be about today. I want to show you why you can't trust just white people. If an Aryan is one of the noble ones, but most whites are not one of the noble ones. And most whites will betray their race more than the blacks would give us trouble. More than the mestizos would give us trouble. And what I'm going to play you today is a perfect example of terrible, terrible treason against the race. And you probably didn't even know about it. So here we go.
On Sweden's largest island, Gotland, located about 60 miles off the southeastern coast of Sweden in the Baltic Sea, we're in the middle of an event called Almedalen Week, a week-long political festival, perhaps unlike any other in the world. Over 25,000 people are gathering on the island to hear political speeches and take part in seminars. Every Swedish political party is represented here, from the Social Democrats to the Greens to the New Feminist Initiative Party. The name Almedalen comes from a park here in Visby, where in 1968, Sweden's education minister at the time, Olof Palme, stood on the back of a flatbed truck and gave one of the rousing political speeches for which he was renowned. Palme went on to become one of Sweden's most transformative prime ministers, up until his assassination on the streets of Stockholm in 1986. He was shot dead just a week after he gave a keynote speech at the Swedish People's Parliament against apartheid in Stockholm. Rumors have swirled for years about the South African government's involvement in his killing. While the United States considered the African National Congress a terrorist organization, the Swedish government openly funded the group for decades, even though it was banned by the South African government. According to many accounts, Sweden was the largest single source of financial aid to the ANC. Shortly after he was released in 1990, Nelson Mandela came to Sweden on one of his first foreign stops after being released from prison. During an address to the Swedish Parliament, Mandela thanked Sweden for standing in the, quote, front ranks of the international forces that have fought against the apartheid system.
We would like to take this opportunity to salute this outstanding democratic institution, the Swedish Parliament, which has stood in the front ranks of the international forces that have fought against the apartheid system. From here, has issued legislation which has made an important contribution to the process of securing the international isolation of apartheid South Africa. For many years, you have approved budgets which have enabled this country to extend invaluable humanitarian assistance to the ANC, the democratic movement, and the sovereign people of our country. From here, you have provided moral and political leadership, which has inspired many others throughout the world and sustained us in those dark days in prison, when it was impossible even to guess when the terrible night of racial tyranny would give way to a new dawn.
That was Nelson Mandela about a month after he was released from prison in 1990 after 27 years in the apartheid prisons of South Africa. The Swedish Parliament was the first parliament he came to address. Well, last night here in Visby, Sweden, one of Mandela's closest associates jailed with him, Ahmed Kathrada, spoke here. Kathrada, who goes by the nickname Kathy, spent 26 years in prison, including 18 on Robben Island. He began by talking about Nelson Mandela's famous statement during his trial in 1961.
No, I remember his words during our trial. Sorry. He ended with the words, I have struggled all my life for a non-racial, non-sexist South Africa. It is an ideal which I hope to achieve. But if need be, it's an ideal for which I'm prepared to die. That was his, in his part of his address to the court. And throughout the trial, the expectation was a death sentence. But in the face of the death sentence, this is how the trial was conducted under the leadership of Mr. Mandela, an ideal for which he was prepared to die. Our whole struggle was for a non-racial, non-sexist, democratic South Africa. In pursuance of our goals, people of all communities paid the supreme sacrifice. It may not be known, but just to mention a couple of names, we had a person by the name of Ruth Slovo. She went into exile and assumed the position of a professor at the University of Maputo. She received a package from the United Nations. Unknown to her, the package went through the South African police. And the South African police planted something in that package. Now that was one of many who paid the supreme sacrifice in the struggle for our democracy. People of all communities, I can talk of Dulcie Hartwell, Dulcie September rather, who was an ANC representative in Paris. She was assassinated in Paris. There's Saluji, there's Timor, who were thrown off the buildings of police headquarters and killed. Ours was historically a struggle for a non-racial, non-sexist, democratic South Africa. That is what sent many people to prison, and that is for many, many of our colleagues lost their lives and were not alive to see the birth of democracy in our country. So we're 20 years old as a non-racial, non-sexist, democratic South Africa. But we have made quite important strides. Every university in our country is mixed now. Almost every university, the rector is black. And one can go on and on to talk of the progress that has been made towards our racial, non-racial society. But coming here tonight is a great honor to be here, because throughout our struggle, one of our greatest friends were the people of Sweden. They supported us throughout our struggle, whereas other Western countries, many of them, connived with the apartheid government. But Sweden in particular and other Scandinavian countries stood by us when our president at that time, Oliver Tambo, caught a stroke. It was in Sweden that he was hospitalized. It was in Sweden that he regained his health and was in a position to return to a free South Africa. I want to once again take the opportunity to thank the people of Sweden for being such close friends of our struggle. We are seeing the fruits of that every day of our lives.
That's Ahmed Kathrada. He is speaking here in Visby, Sweden, just last night. He was one of Nelson Mandela's closest associates. He spent 26 years in prison, including 18 on Robben Island. When we come back, we'll be speaking with the head of the Left Party here in Sweden. We'll also be speaking with the head of the Feminist Initiative, a radical feminist group that already has a position in the European Parliament. Will they take a seat in the Swedish Parliament? And we'll speak with Congressmember, the former Congressmember, Dennis Kucinich, who's here at Almedalen in Gotland in Sweden. Stay with us.
This is a game. Just for someone's amusement, right? Who's in power? But sometimes I think about how few people on this planet really decide everything. 1% or 1%. They are the functional equivalent of God. They must get bored. Well, that doesn't end this game. 13 is the end. 13 never changes. Some contestants think they can walk away, but it's a snuff show.
This is Mario Savio, a student activist at UC Berkeley in 1964, protesting the university's restrictions on political speech on campus.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Today, his famous "put your bodies upon the gear" speech is protected under the First Amendment. But it wasn't always that way. Welcome to Beyond the Black Letter, the law school outline that goes beyond the rules. On today's episode, lawful speech that advocates lawlessness. Speech from 1964 has gotten a lot of attention recently because of the Occupy Wall Street protests. It's a pretty subversive speech, advocating mass civil disobedience to shut down the machine. But it's legal. If I went down to Bruin Plaza here at UCLA and said the same thing, the California or the U.S. government couldn't arrest me and prosecute me for saying it. But that hasn't always been so. And in a very real way, I owe that right to another speech, this one by the Ku Klux Klan. In 1964, the same year as Savio's speech at Berkeley, a Klan leader in Ohio named Clarence Brandenburg invited a local TV news crew to film a rally. A dozen Klan members are on a farm, wearing red hoods and burning a cross. Brandenburg gives a speech about their plans for a march on Washington, D.C. Quote, "We're not a revengeant organization," he says, "but if our president, our Congress, our Supreme Court continues to suppress the white Caucasian race, it's possible that there might have to be some revengeance taken." Revengeance, by the way, is not a real word. And it's not really clear whether these guys were scary or looked pretty pathetic and delusional. It would help to see the original TV news footage, but more on that later. The state of Ohio prosecuted Brandenburg for advocating violence or unlawful methods of terrorism as a means of accomplishing political reform. He appealed his conviction, and the Supreme Court of the United States agreed with him.
Number 492, Clarence Brandenburg, appellant versus Ohio.
At one point during the oral argument, the attorneys for the state of Ohio tried to make a point.
If I were to go, and I use this as an extreme statement, but if I were to run down Harlem, shall we say, and say, bury the Negro, send them back to Black Africa.
You wouldn't last that long.
Probably so, Your Honor.
He was interrupted by Justice Thurgood Marshall, the court's first African-American justice. Later, the attorney for Brandenburg responded.
When Mr. Kirshner suggested that I could run down through Harlem saying, kill the Negroes, and Justice Marshall responded, you wouldn't last very long. But Justice Marshall, who is safe at the moment because the venue is in Washington, D.C., but in Ohio, could be indicted for suggesting a violent reaction by the Negro community. This is the state of the invasion under this statute into the First Amendment rights.
The court in Brandenburg versus Ohio reversed Brandenburg's conviction and set a high bar for when the government can prohibit the advocacy of lawless action.
Under the Brandenburg test, which is the currently existing First Amendment test,
that's Professor Eugene Volokh, who teaches and writes about First Amendment law at UCLA.
The advocacy of crime in general, it's only punishable if it is directed to and likely to produce imminent criminal conduct. So if you're standing there and you're calling people to do something right away, if it's criminal, that's a crime. But if you just say in general, it's a good idea to violate the law and this, that, and the other way, and you ought to be doing that sometime, that is constitutionally protected today under Brandenburg.
So speech like this.
And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers.
Is protected. But it hasn't always been that way.
Hello? Brandenburg, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union. Is it all right?
Yeah, I think that's going to work.
This is Robert Goldstein, professor of law at UCLA.
The modern First Amendment has its beginnings in anti-war speech. we have a volunteer army and enormous firepower these days, but World War One was a war fought with soldiers in trenches, and it required a all-out effort, both at home and abroad. That is, it required soldiers, and it required a mass support. Any deviation from that kind of support was thought to be unpatriotic and undermine the war effort. So prosecutors were quite active, and juries were quite willing to prosecute and convict those who opposed the war.
One such protester was named Charles Schenck.
So Schenck called on individuals to petition their representatives and to use their vote to oppose the war. But
apparently the newspapers during World War One published the names of the young men being conscripted to fight overseas. And so this guy, Charles Schenck, the Secretary General of the Socialist Party in Philadelphia, mailed them pamphlets which argued that the draft was a violation of the 13th Amendment's prohibition against slavery and was a, quote, monstrous wrong, and urged them to not submit to intimidation. On top it said, "Long live the Constitution of the United States." He was prosecuted under the Espionage Act of 1917.
Made it, had a variety of provisions, but the provision relevant here prohibited the obstruction of the recruitment effort.
Schenck was convicted and appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. wrote the court's opinion. Holmes had taken time off between college and law school to fight in the Civil War. Unfortunately for Charles Schenck, he had enlisted.
Right there. Okay. All right. Am I going whenever?
Whenever you want.
Now I get the butterfly.
Here's what he wrote in the court's opinion.
The most stringent protection of free speech would not protect a man in falsely shouting fire in a theater and causing a panic. The question in every case is whether the words used are used in such circumstances and are of such a nature as to create a clear and present danger that they will bring about the substantive evils that Congress has a right to prevent. Thank you. All right.
The clear and present danger is that the nation is at war and that the particular speech is delivered in circumstances that are likely to be persuasive and undermine the war effort in some way, whether that the speech in Schenck is because it's delivered to potential recruits or in Abrams because it's delivered to persons who might strike.
In the Abrams case, four, quote, long-haired anarchists from Russia, as the New York World described them at the time, dropped leaflets from the roof of a munitions factory, urging the workers inside making bombs and bullets to strike.
Threat to the war effort, or because of a very popular political candidate in Debs, being persuasive that the war is oppressive and unfair to those who are fighting it.
That's Eugene Debs, a socialist candidate for president, who was convicted for 10 years for making an anti-war speech. President Harding later pardoned him.
The First World War is what we call the first Red Scare in the history business.
Okay, cool.
Check it again. Check levels.
Yeah, let's just do it one more time.
Okay, my name is Tobias Higby. I'm an associate professor of history at the UCLA.
I stopped by the UCLA History Department to get a better idea of what was going on at the time. There is some disagreement over what to call it.
Red scares, I guess.
Yeah,
and led to
I don't
a lot
like
of
the term red scare.
Okay.
Red scare, again, suggests that it was an unsound scare. It was perfectly sound. We saw that communist groups managed to take over countries and produce untold misery there in revolution and violence and civil war. So whatever was wrong when restricting the speech, it wasn't that people were just pointlessly scared. They were reasonably worried about that speech.
They were worried because these foundational issues about society, things we take for granted today, even after the Great Recession, were being questioned.
You know, you have to think about it as a time of incredible stress for the country. And the question on everybody's mind really was whether or not you could have democracy and this new system of industrialization, of industrial capitalism. Would democracy and capitalism work together? Or would you need some sort of new system? Would you have to modify capitalism, or would you modify democracy?
A law professor at the time, the first scholar to really study the First Amendment, said it best in the Harvard Law Review. Instead of falsely shouting fire in a theater, as Holmes put it, how about somebody who gets up in a theater between acts and informs the audience that the fire exits are too few or locked? Before Brandenburg v. Ohio in 1969, the clear and present danger test was what the courts would use to decide if that person could be punished, sent to jail, for speaking. So what exactly is the test?
Well, we don't know what exactly the test was, because the court never specifically defined it and applied it in different ways. So it said speech is protected unless it creates a clear and present danger of certain harms that the government is empowered to prevent. But what? How clear it has to be? How present it has to be? Is it present in the sense of immediate, or present in the sense of the danger is of some harm that might happen not that long from now? Whether there's a separate intent requirement, that was never clear.
And it opened the door to legislatures, where the majority rules, to declare some speech dangerous. In other words, to automatically pose, by law, a clear and present danger. The Espionage Act of 1917 prohibited obstruction of military recruitment, but
the obstruction part was not a speech statute. It was a prosecutor who came forward and said, this speech obstructs. But the cases that the court got after the war were speech crime cases, where the legislature described certain speech as being dangerous speech.
These laws made it illegal to advocate a change in industrial ownership by means of sabotage, violence, illegal means of terrorism, etc. Pretty vague stuff. One of the more well-known prosecutions was of Charlotte Whitney, a daughter of a prominent family in California, who went from being a charity worker to a member of the Communist Party. She was convicted, and the U.S. Supreme Court affirmed. The governor of California eventually pardoned her.
The problem isn't just that the clear and present danger test was used to restrict speech. The problem is that sometimes it was used to restrict speech, sometimes to protect speech. It came in different flavors. So if a court today was to say the right test is clear and present danger, it's not so much that it's announcing the test that will reach the wrong results. It's announcing a test that we don't know what results it will reach. So if you want a test that's protective, you want one that's not just one that could be used to protect speech if interpreted the right way, but that is defined in a crisp enough way that once it sets a precedent, presumably future courts will be using it to protect speech.
And that brings us to the masses.
The Mathis case, and that was a case in which the Postmaster General exercised his authority, also under the Espionage Act, to close the mails to magazines that similarly obstructed the war effort. This was the Mathis, a very respectable left-wing magazine.
Sure, I know the Mathis.
What do you know about it?
I don't know about the case, actually.
So the
Mathis comes out of the socialist movement, and it comes out of New York City, and it's edited by important socialist intellectuals. And it's kind of a cultural paper of cultural radicalism, as well as just political radicalism.
What would it be akin to today?
More radical than The Nation, for sure. More radical than In These Times, or I'm trying to think, it's sort of like
magazine.
Against the Current or something. But it would be, it's hard to, you would have to think about it as like Time Magazine.
Time Magazine.
You know, the People's World or something like that. So they're
no
idea. Very, they would have very, very high-end intellectuals like Upton Sinclair and Lincoln Steffens. And
try to imagine the U.S. Postal Service today banning a political magazine. But at the time, these magazines were a new and persuasive form of media.
This is a period when magazines are transitioning into, you know, glossy covers and printing photographs, and so it's not just text anymore. It's more interesting and engaging. And
potentially subversive. The masses printed anti-war material, including a series of cartoons
that opposed the war that today could run in any newspaper.
Like, one cartoon was of death using a tape measure to measure a draftee for a coffin. And they had poems written by jailed war protesters, stuff like that. But here's the thing. The federal judge who heard the case found in favor of the masses and prevented or enjoined the postmaster from banning the magazine from the mail. His name was Judge Learned Hand.
In the masses case, as a district judge, he proposed the incitement test.
Unlike the clear and present danger test, Hand's test, called the incitement test, would ask,
does the speech incite an individual to action, to take illegal action? Is it a trigger of action?
Stop that coming. Okay. I prefer a test based upon the nature of the utterance itself. If, taken in its setting, the effect upon the hearers is only to counsel them to violate the law, it is unconditionally illegal. By counsel, I mean to persuade them that their interest or duty lies in violating the law. As to other utterances, it appears to me that regardless of their tendency, they should be permitted.
So for him, the court ought to focus on the nature of the words used. Words that suggest that it is in your interest or your duty to do something, not to believe something, but to do something, he said, is an incitement. At that point, the speech would cross a line for Hand from participating in public discourse about what people should believe and how they should exercise their right to vote to inciting an action that would violate a law that was the product of prior public discourse. So,
yeah, it sounds like a real subtle difference from the clear and present danger test, something only lawyers could come up with.
That's right. It's not always easy to apply these standards, but the difference in focus is this. Hand said, rather than trying to predict future harm and rather than trying to assess all the circumstances, especially because judges live in a rarefied world in which they may believe that speech is more dangerous than it is, I'd rather have a judge actually look at the text of the words, evaluate the words themselves.
When Learned Hand looked at the masses, he saw condemnation of the war and praise for conscientious objectors, but no incitement. So he ruled in his favor. But the Court of Appeals shot down his incitement test. They reversed his opinion, writing, quote, "This court does not agree that such is the law." Hand's biographer wrote that the response to the masses case was painfully disappointing for Hand. So it's quite a coincidence that later, on a train ride to New England for a summer vacation, who does he see on the same train? But Justice Holmes. What does he do? Well, what would you do if you saw a Supreme Court justice on the same train or the same plane? Hand had just stuck his neck out to promote free speech during wartime and got shot down by the Court of Appeals. And here's a judge of a court higher than the Court of Appeals. So he strikes up a conversation and tries to persuade Holmes of the importance of free speech and its incitement test in particular. Remember, Holmes is like 30 years older and has about that much more experience as a judge, but Hand can't help it, and they have a friendly debate. Then later, Hand thinks of some points he should have made.
Windsor, Vermont, June 22, 1918. Dear Mr. Justice, I gave up rather more easily than I now feel disposed about tolerance on Wednesday. Here I take my stand. Opinions are at best provisional hypotheses and completely tested. So we must be tolerant of opposite opinions or varying opinions by the very fact of our incredulity of our own. I agree that in practical application there may arise some difficulty, but I...
He sends the letter off, and lo and behold, he gets a reply.
Beverly Farms, Massachusetts, June 24th, 1918. Dear Hand, rarely does a letter hit me so exactly where I live as yours, and unless you are spoiling for a fight, I agree with it throughout. My only qualification, if any, would be that free speech stands no differently than freedom from vaccination. I enjoyed our meeting as much as you possibly could have and should have tried to prolong it to Boston, but that I feared my wife would worry. Sincerely yours, O.W. Holmes.
no differently than freedom from vaccination? Didn't Holmes understand a word he had said? Free speech matters. So Hand writes Holmes another letter and gets another reply.
Supreme Court of the United States, Washington, D.C., April 3rd, 1919. Dear Judge Hand, since your letter came, I've been so busy propagating new sophistries, etc., that I haven't had time to defend the old ones. And now I am afraid that I don't quite get your point. I don't see how you differ from the test as stated by me, so I don't know what the matter is or how we differ so far as your letter goes. With which I send you my blessings and don't hold you bound by your adieu to this stage. Yours sincerely, O.W. Holmes.
Perhaps Hand was more to the point in a letter to a friend.
I am not wholly in love with Holmes's test, and the reason is this. Once you admit that the matter is one of degree, while you may put it where it genuinely belongs, you so obviously make it a matter of administration, i.e. you give to Tom, Dick, and Harry, district judge, so much latitude that the jig is at once up. The nine elder statesmen have not shown themselves wholly immune from the herd instinct, and what seems immediate and direct today may seem very remote next year. I own I should prefer a qualitative formula. Hard, conventional, difficult to evade. If it could become sacred by the incrustations of time and precedent, it might be made to serve just a little to withhold the torrents of passion, to which I suspect democracies will be found more subjected.
Learned Hand was sort of a lone voice in this regard, right?
He was a lone voice, and it probably kept him off the circuit court for a while. He was eventually elevated to the circuit court, but it didn't make him popular during World War One.
Is it possible that he didn't become a Supreme Court justice for that same reason?
It's possible.
The question is, why did Learned Hand care? The country was at war. Socialists were trying to start a revolution. Why should this up-and-coming judge stick his neck out?
The core claim is that any democratic society has to have substantial protection for free speech, because democracy involves not just the vote, but free discussion among the citizenry before the vote and after the vote. So if we define democracy as, well, that's where people get to vote, we would have left out half or more than half of the story. Democracy is where people get to vote after they've talked about it. And then they haven't just handed over power to their elected representatives. They keep on getting to talk, and they keep on getting to debate. They keep on getting to criticize that whole time that the office holders hold office. Hand was clear that it's that debate that underwrites the legitimacy of the office holder, not the vote on the first Tuesday of November. That makes the choice, but the ongoing legitimacy is underwritten by the existence of a realm of public discourse or public opinion that is constantly being developed and generated during the entire period in which an office holder is holding office and making decisions.
So speech like this,
and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers,
is protected.
That was Hand's clear contribution.
So that's very interesting.
Yeah, it is very interesting, isn't it?
Holmes eventually came around and started to dissent in the more outrageous prosecutions of war protesters and socialists. And the Brandenburg test
is directed to and likely to produce imminent criminal conduct.
which replaced the clear and present danger test, is considered by some to be a combination or marriage of Holmes's clear and present danger test and Hand's incitement test. At the very least, we can view it as
a summation of 50 years of prior doctrine.
In the end, though, these legal rules or tests are just words themselves. The real difference is what we've learned as a society over the years, looking back at our experiences as a nation, how our sensibilities, our expectations have changed.
That's why, I mean, in a sense, it's why it's good that you're studying these laws. I mean, theoretically, the First Amendment gives us these protections, but it had to be won. Those protections didn't really just exist in the abstract before World War I. They were put into place because of the struggle over free speech, and those freedoms can be taken away if there's a counter struggle, and they will be. I guarantee it.
Thanks to Eugene Volokh.
Untold misery there in revolution and violence.
Robert Goldstein.
I don't know how you're going to edit all this.
and Tobias Higbee.
I'm trying to think. It's sort of like against the current or something. But it would be.
Any factual errors or dubious interpretations are mere mistakes.
Which tends to convince me at this late date in my age that having pursued every tributary and every form of activism, that democracy definitely is not the system to advance the white race. That's not because in a very highly educated white society, people could not be responsible, could be responsible for voting, knowing what the hell they're voting about and determining what's going to happen and have plebiscites all the way down to the state level to where people could vote on all important issues. Unfortunately, that's not the case, and what we're living under this alleged democracy is not a democracy at all. Even if democracy's worked great. Beyond that, my position from so much public contact over the years on politics, that the electorate are too stupid to run the system. They're just too stupid. And even there's even the ignorant, intelligent ones. People who are fairly highly educated that still act and talk and write ignorantly. So even though there are the other forms of system, well, of course, as Professor Stuart Crane said, there's only one form of government, and that is oligarchy. And rule by the few. And really, it's always been that way. It's just covered by a facade of so-called democracy or republic or king or whatever. So anyhow, I guess all this discussion and worrying about it is beside the point, because it doesn't operate at all in any of these other features like people say they do. The ruling class tell you how it operates, but it don't operate that way at all. It's simply another oligarchy, ruled by the few, and usually, you know, probably in every case, the people with the most money control the system, the ruling class. And if it becomes unbearable to live under the ruling class, then you rise up and cut their throats. And pretty soon there'll be another ruling class, hopefully that will bend more to your point of view. That's as close as I can get to talking about the natural law and might is right and just the way things are and human nature. I mean, people go on and on and on and on about the minutiae of politics and philosophy and all that. But most of it is a waste of time. I hear it in the right wing on their radio shows, that, or their white nationalist shows, that instead of going right to the point and say, we got to take these guys out and put these guys in, boom, how are we going to do it? They piss around and never really come to any conclusion that would cause them to grasp the bull by the horns and ride. And I think a lot of it has to do with the simple recognition by a lot of intelligent white people that shall I give my life for this rabble, stupidity that surrounds me, even my own race, not even including the other races. What will it gain? Okay, you got to think that all over. I think it's best to let the system's empire collapse on its own. They always do. They always eat themselves from the inside. And I think that's the only way, and then try to replace it with something that works a little better. Well, let's close out with a response here from one of our lone wolves out there about the Alan Combs interview with the Klansman yesterday. TT, I listened to that Combs versus Klan interview, and I have to say, despite the fact that Combs is a liberal Jew, he thrashed the Klan guy and made him sound like an idiot. Yeah, I've been on Combs' show before. He treated me fairly decent. It's been quite a while, but like I say, I did a show once or twice, I guess. Combs zeroed right away on Christianity and focused on the very obvious conflict in the Klan's logic. You simply cannot escape the fact that as a Christian, that if Jesus existed, he was, number one, a Jew, and number two, Semitic and not white. Add to that the fact that Combs points out that nothing in Christian doctrine makes it pro-racial religion. This is the fatal flaw of all those pro-Christian racists. It justifies logic. One thing I will say about Combs is he's a very smart guy and always treats his guests fairly. He may be a liberal Jew, but this really shows the logical flaw behind any pro-racial Christian group. You simply cannot celebrate a religion based on the worshiping of a Semitic Jew and be pro-racial unless you're a moron. Okay. I guess he put that out pretty straight. Cool. Well, so far today, I've heard no Chinese fireworks going on around here, and I'm happy about that because my Siberian Husky just goes bonkers when they start blowing up things. And I'm thankful because of all the veterans around, the ones who have seen combat. And hear all this booming and banging. It affects them quite a bit. I'll be back with you tomorrow. What is today? Wait a minute. This is Freya's Day. Yeah, Freya's Day. Ladies' Day in the bunker. And I'll be back tomorrow, Saturn's Day, to close out the week.